Growing the Game with Ballsy is a podcast dedicated to growing the game of football in Saskatchewan. Each week, Michael Ball will talk with Rider guests, but he'll also highlight amateur athletes, coaches, and builders in his province, growing the game we love. Now, here's Ballsy.
And this podcast is brought to you by Pizza Huts in Saskatchewan. If you're in the mood for pizza this weekend, make sure you check out Pizza Huts takeout or delivery. Also, Mark Greshner Photography. His fine work can be found at markgreshner.com. He also provides the picture of Mosaic Stadium on my podcast background when you check it out at podbean.com. It's also obviously available at Spotify and Apple too, the podcast that is. But thanks to Mark Greshner for his great work. Paul Waldo at Royal LePage in Regina. If you want to get in the real estate game, give the three-time Grey Cup champ a call, 306-502-5355. Also, like to thank SAS Selects Football for getting on board, building the stars of tomorrow today. Thanks to Zelko Stefanovic for his support of not only amateur athletes, but this conduit to promote amateur athletes growing the game with Ballsy. Also want to thank our friends at Boys Next Door Window Cleaning. Nathan and Landon have a deal right now. If they come and clean your windows and somehow they get dirty within 5 days of that cleaning, they'll come back and touch up 10 windows free of charge. They have a website coming soon, but you can check them out on Facebook, Boys Next Door. And I also want to thank a new sponsor, Riviera Ag Seeds, Southern Saskatchewan's premium certified seed grower, delivering homegrown certified Durham yellow peas and chickpeas. And normally in this spot, we talk football, of course, because this is a podcast dedicated to growing the game of football in Saskatchewan. But we're going to deviate a little bit here because, well, it's my podcast. I can do what I want. And there's a documentary or a series of episodes in this TV program called Dark Side of the Ring. And the last episode of the season was one dealing with Owen Hart. I'm on the phone now with Kelly Rempel, the Silver Fox, a guy known around these parts. Great guy. Handles my money, should handle yours too, although you have more money than me. Anyway, we are talking about Owen Hart, because Owen Hart on this day in 1999 at the Over the Edge pay-per-view suffered a terrible accident and perished in the ring there that day at the Kemp Arena in Kansas City, Missouri. Kelly is a friend of Bret Hart, a friend of the Hart family, was at the funeral, so he's taking a few minutes out of his time to talk to us. So Kelly, first off, you've watched, obviously, I'm going to assume you've watched The Dark Side of the Ring and that season finale here, second season finale dealing with Owen Hart. In 44 minutes, did they do a pretty good job, you think?
I did. I thought it was one of the better documentaries that they did. There were some of the series that I, you know, obviously liked more than others, and I thought that was pretty well represented. WWE, not surprisingly, really didn't have somebody to sort of represent their side of the story. But in saying that, I'm not sure what their side of the story would be. I mean, it's pretty obvious that in hindsight, and, you know, we can all be, you know, the rear view mirror guy. In hindsight, it was a terrible decision. And, you know, we all wish that it never would have happened. But I thought that the guys did a pretty good job of, you know, articulating what happened that tragic day. Yeah.
Did you watch that pay-per-view? And I'll get into how you found out and everything about that in a second. But did you watch that pay-per-view? Obviously, I saw the clip. I didn't watch it. I saw the clip of Jim Ross, because he was one of the guys they interviewed. I just want to say, as a guy in broadcasting, and you have kind of been around the periphery of broadcasting, what he did that night just to keep it together was one of the great broadcasting feats I think I've ever seen.
Jim Ross is one of the greatest broadcasters that I've ever seen. So not surprising that a guy that's that much of a pro, would be able to handle that situation with the grace and the class and the poise that he did. And what really got me choked up a little bit was when Jim Ross on the documentary talked about the scene where, you know, he's sitting in the chair, and although the lights were turned out when Owen fell to the ring, they really didn't know what had happened other than the fact that something terrible had happened and Owen had fallen. And Jerry Lawler had ran into the ring to see how Owen was doing. And when he came back, you know, he was white as a ghost. And they knew it was really bad, but they didn't know how bad, in the sense that they didn't realize that he had passed. And the producer a guy by the name of Kevin Dunn, who's been there for 100 years, one of the longest-serving employees and most loyal soldiers to Vince McMahon in the WWE, or WWF at that time, said something to Jim Ross in his earpiece as they were about to come out of a promo and back to live action. He said something to the effect of, can you give everybody the announcement on Owen? And Jim Ross said in the headset to Kevin Dunn, he said, I don't know what happened. I don't, nobody's told me the outcome. What am I telling them? And Kevin Dunn said, oh yeah, Owen died. And we're coming back in 5, 4, 3. And I'm just sitting there thinking to myself, how on earth would you be able to do that?
It's crazy.
And so he did it the best way he could, without completely falling apart, you know, on the air, which nobody could have blamed the guy if he did.
Yeah.
And he somehow was able to come back and in a soft, professional, but, you know, soothing sort of way, explain to the live audience that Owen Hart is dead.
Hey, let me ask you a question. And we're going to rewind because this is a football podcast. And we'll talk about the athlete that Owen Hart was. And he was a good football player, too. I want to go into this. Where were you when you're watching this thing? Like, you know the family. You've hung out with Owen Hart. Where are you when you're watching this thing? Who are you watching this with? And are you watching it with a box of Kleenex?
Are you talking about the documentary?
I'm talking about the documentary. Like, where are you watching Dark Side of the Ring? You know, like, I can't imagine you watching this thing and not being gut-wrenched.
Yeah, it was tough. I watched it on YouTube the day after it was released, and I was in my office watching it, and there was a part about halfway through the documentary where they were talking about the fall and everything that had happened, and there was a couple of moments that really got me, and I had to stand up, and I walked over to the door, and I closed my door, and I hoped that nobody was going to walk in the office while I was watching it, because there was a couple of moments there that, you know, I got choked up for sure. I mean, how could you not?
Okay, let's talk about Owen Hart, the outstanding athlete, because he was a great wrestler, but let's talk, he played football, and he was a great amateur wrestler, like, and a track athlete, too. Like, this guy could have gone in a number of different directions as an athlete.
You know, Owen, you know, Brett would tell you this himself, that Owen was the best amateur wrestler of all of the Harts. Up until Owen, Brett had been the best. I think Brett, if I'm not mistaken, he won the Calgary City Championships once, maybe twice, but I know he did once for sure, which when you think about it, there's more people that live in Calgary than live in Saskatchewan. So if you're the best wrestler in the 176-pound weight class in all of Calgary, you're obviously, you know, pretty good. You can go, you know. And yet Brett said that in comparing himself to Owen was a far more accomplished amateur wrestler than him. He was, I think at one time he was ranked in the top 5 in all of Canada in wrestling in college. And, you know, I don't know. I think that, you know, Owen was probably in some ways even more destined to be a pro than Brett, because Brett didn't really aspire to be a pro wrestler. He wanted to get into film and, you know, be a TV, sort of a behind-the-scenes television director type.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of fell into it because his dad needed, you know, guys, and the business was not great at the time. And he started out as a referee, you know, working refereeing and then setting up the ring. And then the next thing, you know, Mr. Hito and Sakurada are knocking on his door at 5 o'clock in the morning, dragging him down to the dungeon to do bumps. And next thing you know, he's wrestling. But it was never really, I don't think, his dream. And I don't know that it was Owen's dream either, but I do remember being a kid, you know, in grade 7 or 8, I think it was. I want to say that it was like 85 or 86 when Stampede Wrestling had kind of started up again.
Right.
If you remember, it went away for a couple of years, and then Bruce somehow convinced his dad to start it up again, like he hadn't already lost enough money. But I just remember Owen being really young, at that time, like 23 or 21 or 22 or 23 when he got into it. And so I think that, you know, after his college days, I think he was just so talented and such an amazing pure athlete. Like, the truth is, Owen was more athletic in some ways than any of the other Harts. Brett was more of a mechanic or a technician in the ring. Owen was a little bit more like Shawn Michaels, you know, or Eddie Guerrero. I mean, those guys came, about the same time, I guess. But Owen was the guy that inspired guys like Chris Jericho and, you know, Sean Waltman, who later became the 1-2-3 kid, like those types of guys. Because he was doing stuff in the ring that nobody had ever really seen before. He kind of invented a style where he took little parts of things that he'd seen in Japan or Mexico or Europe and sort of incorporated, like, Dynamite Kid and Davey Boy Smith. Right. But sewed pieces of that along with, like, the Mexican, like, Lucha Libre-type style and some of the stuff that he'd seen in his time in Japan. And he created something that nobody had ever seen before.
Yeah.
So this is before the internet. And, you know, if you listen to guys like Bruce Pritchard or you listen to different, you know, guys that are, you know, were in the wrestling business in different territories, they'll tell you that they'd heard about this kid from Calgary who was, you know, Brett's brother and Stu's son that was doing this incredible stuff by using the ropes. You know, he'd run up and he'd stand on the ropes and he'd jump up and he'd land on his rear end and then do a backflip, or he'd do drop kicks off the top rope that were done in a way that nobody had ever seen that style of high flying athletic acrobatic type wrestling, but still believable enough to have you think that, you know, like, it wasn't hokey, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. So
but his amateur wrestling was definitely but he also had the ability to sew his amateur style into his wrestling fabric to make it believable. It was an incredible gift that guy had.
Yeah, for sure. And like I said, the guy could tackle you in the backfield or jump off the top rope. He could do anything, and it all translated well into the wrestling ring. Now, this is something interesting because he said the Stampede Wrestling was there when I was a kid watching as a young kid with my grandpa. Then it went away. Then it came back. When it came back, Owen Hart was Stampede Wrestling's version of Hulk Hogan. He was big, he was tanned, blonde hair, just more athletic than Hulk Hogan, but he was really the face of that organization, wasn't he?
Yeah, and it was obvious right from the very beginning. You know, I remember talking to Bruce about this years ago. Bruce knew when he was training Owen that Owen was special. He just, sometimes you just know, you know? Somewhere along the way, I'm sure somebody recognized at a fairly early age that Michael Jordan was going to be better than just your average NBA star.
Right.
You know, there's just some guys that are just so gifted athletically that even if they have half the passion that somebody else has, they're just so damn good that they're going to be special. And Bruce told me that he knew Owen was going to be great, but Owen was motivated. You know, he didn't maybe, and we can get into this a little later if you like, but he maybe didn't take the wrestling business quite as serious as somebody like Brett, in the sense that, you know, he was going to let it kind of ruin him. And, you know, Owen was still, you know, family first and all of those kinds of things. But he was very much a guy who when he was in the ring, he respected the code. You know, he tried to make it as believable as he could. If you go back on YouTube and watch his promos, he was never a Ric Flair, Roddy Piper, you know, quality type of promo necessarily, but it was believable. You could believe in Owen. And his feuds with guys like Bad News Allen and Mocking Singh and some of that stuff was ahead of its time. You know, he was... And guys, and those guys, if you watch some of those shoot interviews where guys years later talk about guys they worked with, they all loved working with Owen because Owen could make a broomstick look like $1 million in the ring. Like, he was just so good that you really didn't have to do much working with Owen Hart. He could just bump Bore all over the ring and do all his stuff, and he could make a very average wrestler look like they were one of the greatest wrestlers on the planet. That's the skill that guys like Brett and Owen had.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's... But again, there are some guys, and I use a guy like a Shawn Michaels, you know, Owen. There are some guys that are so just purely athletic that they make very complicated, difficult moves look like it's easy.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you take a look at a guy like Randy Moss in the NFL.
Yeah.
He made incredibly difficult catches look like they were easy because he's just that good.
Yeah.
No. And Owen was one of those guys in wrestling.
Okay, so people ask, how does Kelly Rempel know this family? Well, you know him because you were one of the higher-ups with the Regina Pats, and you brought Bret Hart in for a promotion. So that's how you kind of got tied into the family and became a really good friend of Bret Hart. So we know you have a background with Bret Hart, and you've talked about Bruce and some of these guys that you've talked to. But did you really have an opportunity to get to know Owen Hart?
Well, look, Mike, I would be lying if I came on your podcast here and tried to, you know, tell everybody that Owen and I were thick as thieves and we used to travel together and, you know, I stayed at his home. Like, I had that kind of a relationship with Brett. We used to go on road trips together and spend lots of time together, still do. Owen, I didn't have that kind of a relationship with, but what I will say is back in 1998, the spring of 98 or the summer, I just don't remember. I just remember it was a beautiful day. So it was probably between, you know, June and August or something, maybe May or September. I just remember it was a beautiful day, and I was visiting Brett for the weekend, and Brett said to me, he said, well, did I mention to you that I'm doing a Disney show with Owen tomorrow? And I said, no. He says, yeah, they're shooting Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, not the movie, Michael, but the TV series.
Right.
And they were shooting it in Calgary, which is interesting, at the soundstage there.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, do you want to come along? I thought, well, of course. Like, that sounds like a lot of fun. So I don't know if you know anything about movie sets, but you could be in three different movie sets. You could be in three different scenes, but you might be there 15 hours.
Right.
You know, one scene might be at 10 in the morning, one at 3, and one at 10 at night. Like, so they had a trailer, and they did have three or four scenes, but we were there from like 6:30 or 7 o'clock in the morning until literally like 2 or 3 in the morning the next day. Like, we were there for hours and hours and hours, like 20 hours or some crazy thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you can only imagine when there's only three of you in a trailer, basically, for the entire day. You know, you get to know somebody pretty well in a short period of time. I probably got to know him better that day in the 18 or whatever, 20 hours I spent with him, than if I would have been with them 9 different times for 2, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
We had nothing but time to chat and get to know each other. And then, you know, the next day, which is, you know, a pretty heavy day for me. And as I think back on days like today, Brett had said to Owen, he said, well, you know, I've got the rough cut of my documentary called Wrestling with Shadows. He said, are you interested in seeing it? And Owen said, well, I can come see it tomorrow, but it's got to be between, you know, 1 and 3, I'll say. I don't remember the time, but he had a tight window. And Brett said, well, I'm not going to be able to be there between 1 and 3. I have an appointment. But Kelly will be at the house. Watch it with him. So Owen came over, and you can only imagine how fascinating it was for me to sit beside Owen on a couch and watch that Wrestling with Shadows documentary, considering the story there.
Well, yeah, so the story of Wrestling with Shadows, if people don't know, that's the Montreal Screwjob where Brett's going to leave to go to the WCW, and that's all amicable in terms of Vince knows he's going, but Brett doesn't want to drop the belt in Montreal, and then Vince McMahon screws over Brett, and then we know, if you know wrestling, you know what happens. It's one of the, it is probably the biggest screw job in wrestling history. But anyways, you're watching the director's cut here in Bret Hart's house with Owen Hart. So you and I, you know, truth be told, you and I talked about this before we started rolling tape here. I think it's if you can portray it the way you portrayed it to me when we weren't recording, it is captivating. So we paint the picture. You're in Bret Hart's basement. You're on the couch. You're watching this with Owen Hart. And I think it, because I had asked you, I said, you know, did Owen Hart really not like wrestling that much? Did he really? Because that's the way Martha's painting it. And it's funny you say this, because earlier in this interview, you had said, you know, Brett really didn't want to go into wrestling. He wanted to be behind the scenes, being a director, being in movies, doing that type of thing. And he takes it really seriously. And Owen doesn't seem like he really, like he's serious when he's in the ring, but it doesn't seem like, he doesn't have he has passion, but not in the sense that it's like, it's cut and dried. It's black and white. He lives and breathes wrestling.
I think that's fair. On the other hand, I don't want to give people the impression that Owen didn't take the wrestling business seriously, because he did. But Brett was like, the ring was his canvas.
Yeah.
And yeah, it didn't matter whether Brett was wrestling in front of 3,000, 30,000 people. It didn't matter. He was going to give everybody everything they had every single time he went out. Owen had the same type of mentality. You got to remember, they grew up in the family business where, you know, Stu, you know, insisted that, guys, you give it 110%. Doesn't matter whether we're at the Moose Jaw Kinsman Arena in front of 200 people, or whether we're wrestling at the Corral during Stampede Week in front of 7,000. Like, these people paid their money. You'd put on a great show. But I would agree, and you know, that I just don't think Owen let the wrestling business ever sort of get to him the way that, you know, maybe some of those old school guys did, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so getting back to your question, I'll just kind of, the best way to do is maybe just kind of pick out a couple of sort of like the highlights I remember from watching that documentary with him.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember at one point in the documentary, Brett kind of had tears in his eyes, and he did not want to, I don't want to get too deep in it, because we'll lose some people and they won't know what the heck I'm talking about. But there was the biggest reason that Brett didn't want to drop the belt to Sean really didn't have anything to do with the whole Montreal thing, although that was part of it. It was that he and Shawn Michaels did not get along. Shawn had disrespected him so much in the past that Brett just refused to lose to him. It was, he would lose to anybody, but he just couldn't stomach the idea that after he came back to Vince's company, after Vince had begged him to stay, he took 40 cents on the dollar for what WCW was going to pay him. And then Vince wanted him to lose in Montreal to the one guy that he can't stand. And at one point in the documentary, Brett got tears in his eyes, and he looks at the camera and he says, and I don't think he was being literally speaking, but figuratively speaking, he says to the camera, he says, I just as soon blow my brains out as do what they're asking me to do.
Hmm.
And I just remember Owen got so agitated by that. I just remember he yelled at the television, stop talking like that. And it kind of took me back, and I kind of sat back in my chair. And he looked at me and he shook his head. He says, I just hate it when he says things like, I can't believe, like, it's wrestling, Brett. He's talking to himself like in the third person.
Right. Kinda.
He's like, Jesus, it's wrestling. And then he calmed down, and then they get a little further into the documentary, and then we had a few laughs.
Yeah.
When they went through the screw job part, well, actually, another excellent moment in there was when they were watching the documentary, and there was a part where Brett was having sort of these flashbacks where he's sitting, I think it might have been in his pool room, I'm not sure, but the lights are kind of out, and he's sitting there reflecting on some of the corporal punishment that Stu would give him when he'd stretch him. And it's a little bit dark, you know, to think, but yeah, Stu is an old school guy, so this was back at a time when if you kind of spanked your kids or you disciplined them that way, it really wasn't looked in society like it was that big a deal.
Right.
But Stu probably went a little too far on a couple of occasions, and Brett was reflecting on, the way Stu would stretch him and kind of punish him that way, and try to teach him a lesson. And I remember Owen looked at me, and he looked at the TV, and he looked at me, and he said, I'd like to say that he's stretching the truth here, but my dad was pretty hard on him.
Mm-hmm.
And he got kind of, not choked up, but he kind of took him back to a time that probably was a little dark for him too.
Right.
But the one that sticks out the most, and, I'll try to get through this without, getting too emotional here, because I think I did when I talked to you off the air, but
can't blame you, by the way. I can't blame you.
Yeah, the part that really got to me, and it still does, and every May 23rd, I think about this, and I think about it every time I kind of get into deep thought about Owen and how he died. We're walking out the door, and he's putting his shoes on, and he looks at me, and he says, Brett's going through a tough time. He was going through a divorce at the time. And he says, Brett's going through a tough time. He's going through a divorce. He's still trying to get over what happened to him with Vince. He says, I just hope that he finds a happy place. He goes, the wrestling business is just, I've learned it's not worth getting this upset about. It's not what we grew up with. It's times have changed. And I understand that Brett's very upset, but he's got to get on with his life and kind of move on. He said, the only thing I'm thinking about right now, Kelly, and he takes two or three more steps and he turns back and he looks at me. He says, I want to put in two or three more years. I want to make as much money as I can. And I just want to be a dad.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't want this anymore. I just want to be safe. Three more years. I'm done. Well, I guess he didn't get that chance, did he?
No, Kelly. Well, he unfortunately, and I say this unfortunately in the sense that he's not around, but he did set his family up for the rest of his life. He looked after his family. Unfortunately, he's not around to see it. So, Kelly, if you can remember, how far was that conversation from when this day actually happened in 1999? Like, what was the time frame between when he walked out and last time you talked to him to the time you found out he died?
Well, the last time that I actually spoke to Owen was at a house show in Calgary. So that wasn't the last time I spoke to Owen.
Yeah.
But it was the last conversation that I had with him that lasted longer than, say, 2 minutes, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
I saw him one time after that, and that was when WWF was at a house show in Calgary. And Brett had not seen all of those guys since the screw job, so that was also interesting. Because we walked into the Saddle Dome, and of course, when Brett walks into the Saddle Dome, even the security guards and that are all practically on their knees, oh my God, the legend, So he comes walking through the concourse, but there was sort of this awkwardness where everybody was just on eggshells because he hadn't seen Earl Hebner.
Right.
He hadn't seen a lot of those. Like the referee that that was talked into doing what he did to, he hadn't seen a lot of those people. So I was nervous. I didn't know how it was going to go. And I remember Owen was really nervous because I remember Owen walked over to Brett, in fact, and he said, Brett, Earl really wants to say hi. He really wants to talk to you. Please talk to him. He's a wreck. He knows you're here. Would you just talk to him? And I remember Brett said, yeah, sure, I'll talk to him, or I'm kind of paraphrasing, but that was the gist of it. And I just remember he was getting a cooler over at the drink, and he looked over at me, and we were about 10 feet apart, and all he said was, hey, Kelly, how you doing? I said, I'm doing great. How are you, Owen? He says, excellent. And that was kind of about it, because he was in a rush to kind of get his drink and get back to his meeting or wherever he was going.
Hey, let me ask you this. How awkward is that for Owen Hart, from what you can gather, Owen and Brett and their dynamic? Because Owen stuck around the WWE or WWF after the screw job. Like, he still was on board. After his brother got screwed, he comes in the ring, tells his brothers the story, goes, don't worry about it, don't let it get to you. He's trying to console him in the ring in Montreal, but he stays around in the WWF / WWE. Brett leaves. How did that affect their relationship?
Well, I think that Owen tried to get out of his contract, and they wouldn't let him out. They let Bulldog out, they let Neidhart out, but they didn't let Owen out. So there's not much you can do. I mean, you can't, you know, if he could have quit out of protest, but then he can't go anywhere else either. And I don't think that Brett would expect that Owen would quit out of protest and then not feed his family. So I don't really know the answer to that question. All I can tell you is the conversations that I had with Brett. I never one single time got the feeling that he was angry with Owen because he stayed, because he knew that Owen tried to get out of his contract and they wouldn't let him out. Mm-hmm. So maybe if Owen hadn't have tried to get out, maybe he might have gotten kind of ticked off at him. But he did try, and they wouldn't let him, so I don't think that... I mean, let's put it this way. The day that I was on the set with Honey, I Shrunk the Kids with those two guys was several months after that screw job happened, and they were, like, thick as thieves and laughing and joking and backslapping like they were the best of friends. So at that point, I don't think they could have been closer than they were at that time. Okay. It was great.
Kelly Rempel, so friend of the Hart family here, you know him around town, the Silver Fox, as he goes by. Great wrestling name, too, by the way. That'd be a great wrestling manager name, the Silver Fox. That'd be awesome. I think... J.J. Dillon,
my finishing move would be?
I have no idea. Something like, I don't know, but you could call it like the Thief in the Night or something, because a fox, would, I don't know, I'm just making shit up now. Okay, so Kelly, we'll get to, I want to wrap this thing up on a high note, so we'll get to some of the pranks that Owen Hart, because he was a notorious prankster, and I want to know if you were a part of that or saw those firsthand. But let's go to May 23rd, 1999. You're an avid wrestling fan. Are you watching the pay-per-view?
No, I wasn't. I guess you can, whatever, call me stubborn or, you know, loyal, whatever you want to call it. I didn't watch a lot of WWF after Brett left. I was kind of pissed off, quite honestly.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of stopped watching, you know. I could, but then again, the way that he was treated and the way he was, you know, managed and what they had for him in WCW was so bad that I didn't watch that either. So I really wasn't watching a lot of wrestling at that time, but I just remember one night, it was a Sunday late afternoon, and I was just sitting in my living room. We had company over, my wife and I, and I got a phone call, and I'm sure that there will be some, if not many, of the listeners to this podcast that know Dr. Kelly Rustica.
Yep.
Great dentist in town. I recommend him to anybody. He called me on the phone at home, which was a little unusual. Kelly never, your dentist typically, even though if he is your kind of your friend, he doesn't phone you at home on a Sunday afternoon or a late afternoon or evening or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't remember what time it was. I just remember it was light outside.
Unless it's a Winnipeg dentist and he's trying to save your last tooth, right? Then he's calling you home.
I guess so, yeah. Yeah. But I just remember it was light outside and I was sitting by the window, and on this Sunday late afternoon or evening or whatever time it was, and I just remember I answered the phone and Kelly says to me, he says, are you watching the WWF pay-per-view? And I said, no. He says, I think Owen Hart died. I said, what? He says, I think Owen Hart died. I said, Kelly, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? And, of course, now your blood pressure starts to, mm-hmm. you know, rise. And I'm thinking, what do you mean he died? Like, died in the ring or, like, had a car accident? Like, what are you talking about? And Kelly just said, well, I mean, it's hard to say. He was supposed to start his match, and then they cut to black, and then Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler are trying to explain that something terrible has happened, but they didn't really get into it. And then a half an hour, 45 minutes, or whatever, however long it was later, he said they came back and they announced that whatever had happened to Owen, he was dead. And I just remember, I was just in shock. I mean, I wouldn't have been in the same kind of shock that Brett or Martha or Stu's parents would, or Owen's parents would have been in shock. But I was just, I just couldn't believe it. And then about 45 minutes later, it's on every news channel. And then it kind of sunk in, like, this has actually happened. Like, this guy died not because he got a pile driver that went wrong. He died because he was lowered from a harness in a blue blazer outfit and died because a stunt went wrong. That has nothing to do with wrestling. And I started getting worked up and agitated by it. It's like, what have they got Owen Hart up for in a cable for in the first place? Like, what? Like, that was back when wrestling, everything had to have a gimmick. Everything had to be silly. Everything had to be kind of stupid and and cartoonish. You couldn't just have two guys go in the ring and wrestle. You had to always do something over the top and you know, put people's lives in danger all the time, you know?
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking, like, just what an absolutely horrific way to pass. Imagine laying there with a blue mask on and a robe, dying in the ring in front of 20,000 people. It still kind of pisses me off when I think about it to this day, you know, to be honest with you.
Yeah, no kidding. Hey, Kelly, you went to the funeral. What was that like?
Oh, I've never seen anything like it. Like, I've never been part of anything like that. And you know, I don't even know how to explain it, Michael. It was surreal. I remember, you know, Brett telling me, show up. I want my real good friends to drive together and sit together. We got a special area for you, which I took that as, I mean, I don't know if he ever fully appreciates how much I appreciated that. Think about that gesture.
Mm-hmm.
So I show up to Stu's house, and there's about, I don't know how many, I don't remember exactly, but I'm going to say 10 limousines all lined up in a row. And then there was a couple of his very close friends. One of them was his best friend since he was 4 years old, and I'm riding with him. And another, and his executive assistant, we're all in a car, and we're following the procession, right? In, like, we're going to drive with the limos, if that makes sense.
Right.
So there's all these cars. So between the limos and all of the friends of the family, like the close friends of the family, that all kind of had our areas in the church roped off or, you know, set aside for us, there must have been 35 cars, 10 to 12 limos and about another 20 vehicles. And the entire drive from Stu's house, which is up by the CTV station up at CFCN, up in the top of the hill up there, up, you know, I think it's Bow Trail in Calgary.
Yeah.
For the entire, however far it was, again, it's all kind of a blur, frankly. But I'm going to say a 30-minute drive or however long it was, or 20 or 30-minute drive. All of the streets down all of the trails were all pulled over on the side of the road and people standing on the side of the road to show their respect. And just to see that long a funeral procession, just to drive into the parking lot and see a couple thousand wrestling fans and a great big bus that had all the WWE and wrestlers on it, all of these people waiting for everybody to drive into the parking lot, and you could hear a pin drop. I mean, you got 2,000 people, but if you would have coughed, everybody would have heard it. And I just remember, it was just the emotion of being involved in something like that is just something I'll never forget. And I know I'm rambling at this point, and I'm trying to sort of put that feeling into words.
Mm-hmm.
But Calgary is a big city. It's not like you're driving four blocks.
Right.
And the entire drive, Michael, there was people lined up on the side of the road to pay respect to this guy and to the family.
Yeah.
It was live on the radio, for God's sake. Like, I mean, I've just never seen anything like that, and it was just very, very overwhelming, quite frankly.
How do I put this? I know in the Dark Side of the Ring episode there, Martha said when she went to the funeral home, Owen didn't look anything like himself. So, and they obviously doctored him up as best they could. Was it a closed casket or was it open? Was it like, what was it like inside?
It was open, and yeah, I don't know who. It was open.
Yeah,
and as soon as you walk into the room, it's bang, he's right there. Like, you take three steps to get in the door to get into the church, and there's Owen laying there with an open casket, and it was not. It didn't look like him.
That wasn't Owen Hart. Yeah. Okay. So let's end this on a positive note. I want to end this because one of the other great things we've heard, he's a great wrestler. We heard he's a great father, great husband, as you so eloquently put it there in that last real conversation you had with him. He wanted to get out and enjoy his life. But the other good thing that he was a prankster. He kept everything light. So you, in your limited time, can you give us one prankster story that either you were a witness to or you heard of that was an epic one?
Okay. So there was one that I was a victim of. I'll tell you what happened. So as Brett and I are driving, remember I was talking about the Honey I Shrunk the Kids?
Yeah.
Okay. So as we're driving there, Brett says something about, man, you got to keep your eye on him. I said, really? He goes, oh, this guy will have you doing stuff that you never thought you'd ever, like, just remember that this guy's like the ultimate ribber of all time. So I'm like, okay. Well, it was wee hours of the morning. This is like the last scene they did that day, and everybody's kind of getting a little impatient, maybe just a little cranky. We've been there since, 7 or 8 o'clock, and it's almost midnight.
Right.
And they're doing the scene in the soundstage where there's, they go roll and action, and then everybody kind of starts moving, and it's a hospital scene. So Brett and Owen are walking down the hallway, and there's doctors and nurses, and, if you're going to make it look like a hospital, you got to have a lot of extras that are kind of moving around, or it doesn't look like a hospital.
Right.
So I'm standing there over in the corner, and the assistant director, he's busy over here, and the director, he's kind of standing over here, and he's got the headpiece on. Well, the assistant director is actually the guy that's sort of directing traffic. He's telling people, like, okay, we're going to get started here and all that kind of stuff. Well, they're about 25 feet away from me or so. Like, they're kind of in the other side of the room, and Owen walks over to this assistant director, and he looks at him, and he looks at me. And the guy looks at me, and Owen's pointing to me, and he's kind of, without my hands, it's hard to kind of describe, but he's kind of moving his hand, he's pointing to me, and then he's looking at this guy, and then he's kind of pointing back, and he's looking at this guy. And Owen walks over to me, and he says, hey, Kelly, I got a question for you. He says, do you have your actor card, because I told him earlier in the day that I had been an extra in a couple of movie scenes,
yeah.
which I had been through my wife. Working in film, so I had been an extra before. I said, no, I don't have my actor card. No, I said, I've just kind of done like some jobs, but I'm not an actual official union member. And he goes, ah, damn, hang on a minute. And he goes walking back to this AD, and they're standing there talking, and Owen's looking at me, and he's talking to this guy, and he comes back. He says, listen, he says, if you want to make 300 easy dollars, all you got to do is, if they're looking for another extra in the scene,
mm-hmm.
they're not going to be able to fill out the paperwork right now. They're going to have to do that later. But if you want to make $300, I mean, this scene is like 2 minutes. Like, all you have to do is walk down the hall, and that's it. So I said, oh, okay, well, I'm in for that. Are you serious? He goes, well, hang on 1 second. He goes back to this guy again, and he's talking to him, and he's looking at me, and he's got the hands going, and he's pointing down the hallway. What he's really probably saying to the guy is, yeah, my friend over here is wondering where the bathroom is. Like, where is it? Is it over here kind of thing? But I think that he's getting instructions for me to do this scene. He comes back to me and he says, "You see that doctor's coat over on the wall there?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Well, you said that you're supposed to put that coat on, and then you're supposed to go stand over kind of where that," and this is where he was pointing, so I have no reason to think he's not. So I put this coat on and I go walking around the corner, and they're right about to yell action, and then I had this memory flashback of us driving in the car and Brett saying, "You got to watch this guy. He'll have you doing all kinds of crazy shit." So just before they're about to do the scene, I realize this guy's got me walking down the hall, interrupting an actual scene in a movie. And then I got this vision of the director going, "Cut, cut, cut. Who the hell is this guy?
Get this fucking guy out of here."
So I look. I start laughing, and he starts laughing, and I take the jacket off, and I yell at him, "You're an asshole."
Yeah.
And I put the jacket up on the hook, and he's killing himself laughing, going, 15 more seconds than we'd have had you, you know?
Oh, I love it.
I got one other real quick
go
one.
Ahead.
When they were doing a TV taping in Regina back in 95, I think it was. It was the one where Brett actually had the Rough Riders in his corner.
Right, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, with Glenn Kalka and those guys.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a TV taping. So Vince, who's not usually at the shows, was there.
Oh,
it was,
okay.
They were taping for Monday Night Raw. Well, there was and I don't like to use the word midget anymore because I know we're supposed to call them little people, but in lieu of the fact that at that point in time, it was called midget wrestling. I mean, that's what it was called.
That's what it was, yeah.
That's what it was called. That's what they referred to it as. Well, there was a little person there, and I won't mention his name, but he's been known in Regina to dress up like a leprechaun on St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah. I knew who you're talking about. His contact's actually in my phone. It's funny you say that.
He somehow found a way to manage himself to wrangle his way downstairs with the wrestlers because he'd convinced the security that he was training with them. So anyway, he's down there, and Owen says, "How did you get down here?" And he says, "Oh, I told them that I was training, you know, but I'm not lying because I am training to be a wrestler." And he's all fired up and excited about how he's been taking some bumps, and he's been, you know, in wrestling school, and he wants a job. And he asks Owen if he put in a good word for him to Vince. And Owen tells... He tells him that he will, but he goes, "If you really want to impress him, you got to go in there and tell him yourself. Like, it's not going to, I put in a good word for you, but you got to be the one to go in there and tell Vince." So he sends him into Vince's office while he's right in the middle of a meeting. And he comes back out with his tail between his legs, looking at the ground. And Owen says, "Well, what happened? What happened?" He says, "Oh, he kicked me out of his office. He's mad at me." And Owen says, "Nah, he's just testing you." He says, he wants to know how bad you want it. So he says, "If you're willing to quit, boom, just like that, then you obviously don't want to be a wrestler very bad." "Oh, no, no, no." He says, "I want to be a wrestler." He says, "Well, then you got to get your ass in there and you got to pound your fist on his table and you got to tell him that you're willing to do anything to be a wrestler." And he's got this guy just wired of excitement. But he's a little apprehensive because he's already been thrown out once. But he'd be damned if he doesn't go in there again. And in about 20 seconds, he comes walking back out again, and he's even more depressed than he was the first time. So Owen says, "Look, you got one more chance." Anyway, make a long story short, he sent him in there again, and somehow he convinced him that his best chance is if he lit up a cigarette and smoked in front of him. So the next thing you know, he's in there the third time, and you hear Vince yelling and screaming, "Get the hell out of here. I don't know why you keep coming in here." And he came out, and he looked like he walked into a room and saw that somebody had just, like, shot his dog. He was devastated. But here's what kind of skill set do you have, regardless of the victim, to convince somebody that you're going to make it in the wrestling business if you blow smoke in Vince McMahon's face?
Oh, that is the absolute best. That's exactly how I wanted to end this discussion. Kelly, you are a wonderful storyteller, and you put a nice local spin on a tragic event. Thanks for your insight. I really appreciate it, my friend.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. It brought back some sad memories, but some great ones as well.
This has been Growing the Game with Ballsy. If you have a football story you'd like to share to help us grow the game, email Michael Ball at mball@harvardbroadcasting.com. Ballsy can be heard weekdays in Regina on 104.9 The Wolf Morning Show and during Saskatchewan Roughriders and U of R Rams broadcasts on 620 CKRM.